Good evening.
Good evening, panel.
It would be really good if somebody.
You don't want to sit at this one.
Good evening, testing one, two. Good evening, panel. Want to welcome you to the third meeting, public meeting of the community engagement panel. I hope everyone enjoyed the open house. I just want to remind everyone that this meeting is being live streamed, and we also have a transcription service, and want to thank Melissa Ploy, who's our stenographer, and we also have sign interpretation, and want to thank Robin Babb and Julia Townsend. Appreciate your being here with us tonight. As we begin, I'd like to turn it over to John Frank with PG&E for the welcome.
Good evening. I'm John Frank, the Vice President for Power Generation for PG&E, and I want to welcome everyone to the panel meeting, and certainly I want to thank the panel members for the hard energy and time that they've been spending in the important work that we're doing. I also want to pass on appreciation to the County of San Luis Obispo. This facility that we've been provided really does make it work very well. The ability to both live stream, the audiovisual equipment really does add a lot to the work we're providing, and I want to pass on appreciation for that. There is one update. In previous meetings, we had been talking about the next significant milestone for the decommissioning work that we are preparing for Diablo Canyon was the submittal of the detailed site-specific cost estimate that we have been talking about a March 2019 filing date. We have received a word from the commission that they do want us to submit that by the end of the year. Our schedule had accommodated that possibility. So right now we are intending to meet the date of the end of the year, and we will meet the end of the date of the end of the year to submit the updated cost estimate for the funding decision by the California Public Utilities Commission. And as such, we have scheduled the appropriate public hearings through the engagement panel for land use, which was required to be completed prior to our filing. So we should be good with our schedule. But just to inform both the panel and the public that the next formal filing with the commission will be prior to the end of the year. So with that, turn back to Chuck for
thanks. Before we begin the meeting, we'd like to take a moment to talk about safety. So, Adam, it's up to you.
Yeah, so we have pre-assigned safety roles this evening. These individuals will help facilitate the response in the event of an emergency. So would those with safety roles please raise their hands? Thank you. So if we experience an earthquake this evening, we're just going to duck and cover as best as we can. And when the shaking subsides, we'll evacuate the building. Our exits are in the back of the room here. You'll turn left to the lobby, and then if you make a left there, you'll be on Monterey, and you can also make a right, and you can exit out to Higuera. And I'll turn it back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Adam. This meeting is focused on decommissioning funding. This is the third in a series of eight meetings that the panel has scheduled through this calendar year. And the first meeting focused on the overview of the process. The second on the process and the approvals and the permits that were required for decommissioning. And the topic of this meeting is decommissioning funding. So I'd like to remind the public members that are here tonight that we do have a public comment period. And please fill out the blue cards that are available on the table and turn them in by the break, which will be about 8:15. And the public comment period will take place right after the break. And we all have some white cards out there, too, which is to provide comments and any other information or any input to the panel that you would like to offer. I do want to note that Trevor Keith is not with us tonight in person, but he is he's traveling and he is watching live stream, and he will be providing any notes
or questions to Suzanne, and she'll bring them up to the panel. So he is participating by afar, and I also want to congratulate Trevor. It was recently announced that he has been promoted to planning director for this County of San Luis Obispo. And that is going to, and he's going to continue on the panel, and his position is critical to moving this whole process forward. So congratulations, Trevor. The topic, the first topic this evening is decommissioning funding and status. And Mr. Frank is going to lead that discussion.
All right. Again, tonight's topics are centered around gaining more understanding by both the panel and the public with regard to the funding sources and kind of a little bit of why the funding happens the way it does. So if I go to the next page, you know, as with everything in our business, the regulations determine how things work. In this case, there are both federal and state regulations. The federal are governed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission under the 10 CFRs, Code of Federal Regulation. The states have a variety of agencies that determine how we act throughout the decommissioning process. There are differences between the federal and the state. There's differences in both scope and requirements, and as such, the work that we have to perform and thereby the funding, the way the funding occurs, has to accommodate both federal and state. And why I mention that is it does talk about and create some special requirements that we're going to be talking about today. It's important to recognize that the federal funding, as governed by the NRC, really speaks to radiological decontamination of the facility. The NRC rules requires all nuclear plants while operating to collect funds to a certain amount that ensure that the company owning the facility has enough funds to perform radiological decommissioning of the site. That means removing of all the radioactive sources. The state wants us to go a lot further, as they should. The state requirements in their agencies not only has requirements for radiological remediation, both of which have to be met, both state and federal, but the other agencies in the state require much larger environmental aspects to be addressed during decommissioning, a lot more work than simply the removal of radiological sources. And as such, you know, the state requirements, quite frankly, go much more extensively relative to the work that is required. And we'll continue throughout the process to interact with the state on understanding exactly what those will mean for the site, because there are ways to have certain exemptions or maybe to leave some facilities, and we've had a chance to talk about that already, and that's really subject for the next two meetings. But recognize that the state funding requirements are larger than the NRC's because of the much larger scope. So if I want to focus first a little bit on the 10 CFR, 10 Code of Federal Regulation 50 parts that deal with decommissioning funding. It's kind of a background to understand why we're doing some of the things we're doing. The 10 CFR 5075 requires the establishment of the trust fund. That's the legal precedent for the fund that I just described. And when they're defining the scope required for that fund, it really is to, as the screen shows, it's to remove the residual radioactivity to a level that permits free release of the property. In other words, to allow the property to be used freely without any radiological controls in a safe manner for the public to be able to use that facility again. And that's really, again, the focus of the federal rules. Now, if you look at the site itself, and recognize we're looking at an overview of the entire station, the areas that have potential radioactivity is really limited to those areas of the plant where radioactive work was performed or where the surrounding the reactor and the reactor systems. And if you'll see three areas shown on the overhead where we believe right now has the radiological consequence needs to be remediated. That's the power plant there near the ocean. Above, you see two other areas where radioactive material has been stored. So this represents the radiological scope. Now, because of the federal requirement for a trust fund, it's similar to virtually all utilities that own nuclear reactors. They worked with whatever, you know, most of these plants were started in a regulatory environment where they were regulated assets by a utility commission. And so the normal practice was, as in California, was that the customers of that regulated utility would fund the decommissioning activities as the plant was generating electricity, and that's what's occurred here in California. So a single trust fund was established in the state through the utility commission that funds the decommissioning activities for each of the units. There's one trust fund for Unit 1 and one trust fund for Unit 2. Because that fund is directed by 10 CFR 5075, it is subject to the rules of the NRC and that law. And that law restricts the use of those funds quite a bit, particularly prior to plant shutdown. The ability to use those funds prior to plant shutdown is very restricted. And in fact, the rules are that you can only spend 3% of the fund on, they describe it as paper studies, but essentially preparing for the eventual decommissioning. Okay. Now, when they say 3%, I want to be careful. The NRC has in their own rules a very, very generic number in mind for the completion of this radiological scope. Okay, and again, it's only the radiological scope. And so their number isn't the same 3% as our number or the number of our fund or certainly not the number associated with the complete decontamination and restoration of the site under the state regulations. Remember, those regulations go much further than the NRC's regulations. So right now, the limit is about 1.5% of the current fund, or about 1.5% of what we think we're going to need eventually for decommissioning. Let's call it just over $37.2 million are available to be spent in this 3% for the study work prior to plant shutdown. Okay. There are also limits on how the fund can be used. They're really required to be used for radiological decontamination first. The NRC holds that as the top priority of the funding. And then you can use the money for other activities, such as what the state might require beyond the radiological scope. Why that's important is because those limits limit how much funding is available under the current decommissioning trust fund prior to plant shutdown. I'll talk a little bit more about that. If you look at the current funding level for Diablo Canyon, the last filing was in 2015. It was the 2015 filing. The 2015 filing approved $2.5 billion to be approved for the estimate. At the same time, during that same filing, we filed in conjunction with Southern California Edison Songs Plant, San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. They had, at that point, they were actively into decommissioning. They had performed, by this point, much more detailed decommissioning cost estimates than PG&E had because of where they were in decommissioning. They were had made the decision to actively decommission, and they got an approval of $4.4 billion. Why that's important is the Songs facility and the scope of that work is, it's not exactly the same as Diablo Canyon, but it's very similar. It's essentially decommissioning a dual unit pressurized water reactor. There is some vestiges of an earlier unit at Songs that makes that a little bit different. The size of their facility is much smaller because of the compact nature of their footprint, but it's a fairly good approximation to look at what it may take to do the work at Diablo Canyon. Certainly not a detailed cost estimate. At the time of 2015, we had requested $2.4 billion, but what was approved was $2.5. The commission asked for additional information, did not feel that the filing at that point justified increasing, also in the knowledge that we would have several more attempts to come back to them prior to the plant shutdown. At the time of the submittal for Diablo Canyon, we were actively pursuing relicensing Diablo Canyon, and we had believed at that time that the plant was going to run for an additional 20 years. So lots have changed since the 2015 filing, and we recognize that as we get ready for the future. When I talk about the limit of the funding, this timeline in front of you kind of explains it a little bit. The permanent shutdown is the solid bar on the left-hand side, and we know it's important, and we want to take advantage of the ability to pre-plan out effectively the decommissioning work. That's very important to the people that will be paying for it, because the better you prepare for it, you can do a much better job of controlling the costs to effectively decommission the plant and to do the work. So right now, under the way the rules work, we're limited to $37.2 million. That sounds like a lot of money, but another way to look at it, it's about 1% of what we believe is going to take in order to do the decommissioning work. So we're only spending about 1% of the money to do the pre-planning prior to the final shutdown. In order to get access to additional funds in the trust fund, a couple of things have to happen. First, we have to certify that the plant has been shut down permanently. That's done for each unit when it's that unit shut down. We have to certify permanent removal of all nuclear fuel from the reactor. And we have to file something called a PSDAR, or post-shutdown activities report, with 90 days under the current rules of review in order to gain access to the next 20%. In order to get beyond that 20% of funding, you have to have a site-specific cost estimate in addition to those other submittals. That actually can be done earlier, but it has to be done, and this is kind of a normal timeline that you see for most plants. We really have some advantage here because we know when the date of our shutdown will be well ahead of time, and we can take advantage of that time to do a lot of the work that otherwise might increase the cost of the project if it was done after shutdown instead of before. So we're looking for ways to get access to more than that first 1% of the funding. Why that is important is if you look at the work that we are currently envisioned would have to be done under that 3%. There's a lot of activity that can go on before final shutdown that will allow us to move into the decommissioning work much quickly and much more efficiently. There's NRC licensing work. There's a great deal of state and local permitting work that needs to be done. There's some procurement activity so that we have the equipment available to start the work. And we will be intending to continue to fund the engagement panel. Okay. Now, most sites did as we did here in California, and we established a single trust fund for all decommissioning activities. Since we have a single fund, that fund is controlled by the NRC rules. So even though there is funding available beyond to do work scope outside the NRC purview, it is subject to the control of the NRC exclusion of the 3% unless we do something different. And Eric's going to talk a little bit more about that later. Right now we have we had $2.5 billion approved in 2015. That is invested money. It's about $2.8 billion now, we're under the limit of the 3% at this time. Okay, since the trust fund was commingled, it's going to be limited by that radiological control first, prior to non-radiological decommissioning and the 3% funding. Again, that's very common strategy employed by most states when they design their trust funds for other utilities as well. Okay. Now, since we're going through the efforts to do a very detailed cost study, and we have a lot of work scope that we otherwise know is the right thing to do, the prudent work activities to execute prior to plant shutdown, we're going to exceed our 3% well before the time the plant shuts down. The scope that I just described earlier is important to be done. I want to emphasize that the reason why this work is so important is because by doing the work prior to shutdown, you can lower the overall cost of decommissioning significantly. The faster you can get to certain milestones in your decommissioning, your costs reduce dramatically. But in order to get to those steps, they require permitting, they require NRC licensing activity, they require planning, engineering work. There's a lot of work that can go on while the plant continues to operate, but that work costs more than the 3%. We've talked about it a couple of times in these panel meetings. Diablo Canyon and this community has a tremendous advantage, and that advantage is we have a long stretch of time to get ready for this decommissioning. And the best use of that time is to find ways to be able to do the work more safely, more soundly from a radiological standpoint, to be able to have the best legacy impact on the community, and to find ways to reduce the cost to our customers for the eventual work. And so we're going to be working on ways to find ways to fund those activities going forward. And again, I think Eric's going to talk a little bit about that coming up. So are there any questions? Well, we've got questions at the end, don't we, Chuck?
Thank you. Any questions?
Questions for the panel.
John, Frank?
John, about a month ago, we met all the folks that are on the team that's going to be working on the decommissioning. Is that part of the cost of the 3%?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, it's the folks you met, I would say, are relatively small costs. A larger portion is we have really engaged a lot of industry experts that do this kind of work around the country or have the expertise, equipment, skills to do this, to help generate the report. So part of it is the folks you met. They're doing a certain chunk of the work, and then the remaining part is being done under contract by specialty firms.
Thank you.
Linda.
A clarifying question. You said that you have to file a certificate of permanent fuel removal from the reactors by 2025.
Well, right? There's not a deadline for that.
Oh.
That was one of the requirements to gain access to a greater than 3% of the fund.
Okay.
So, in other words, a normal sequence under the NRC rules for the fund was you would have 3% for planning purposes, and then you would shut the unit down, submit a letter indicating that was the last time the unit would operate, remove all the fuel from the reactor vessel, submit another letter that said that would occur. So those were two of the milestones required to get access to funds beyond the 3%.
Okay. I wasn't thinking reactor vessel. I was thinking spent fuel pools.
No, okay. Just out of the reactor vessel.
Reactor vessel.
Yeah, out of
okay.
The power plant. So
okay.
In a storage facility. In this case, the pool. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Evelyn?
Sherry?
Yes. Could you give an example of what the savings might be if...
I can give a rough number, and maybe Eric or Tom can join
or
in.
Even what would account for the savings rather than the amount.
Yeah, well, okay, so probably Songs is a great example. San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station, they shut down without really expecting to. You know, it was kind of it was an equipment issue that led to a shutdown decision. So they didn't have this kind of long-term planning. They had cost estimates prior to that, but nothing like the kind of pre-planning and the permitting requirements and the agency work and the community work that we are envisioning accomplishing prior to the end of shutdown. And I don't know, Tom, maybe you have a better feel for to this date, they have removed fuel, but they haven't started any decommissioning work despite the fact that they've been shut down for quite a few years, five years. So that all costs money. And I don't know if we kind of have a cost estimate, Tom.
So just using our 2015 estimate numbers, the annual average for carrying cost is around $85 million a year. So that's all the security, the staff to operate, circulate water to cool the pools, all the power you'd consume, you name it, what we have to do while we're in, and that would be for a safe store situation. That carrying cost roughly, again, in 2015 dollars, $85 million a year. So, for instance, the CPUC order that asks us to look at moving the fuel forward 3 years, you start to pick up almost $250 million if you can do that and complete the project sooner. So that's why this pre-planning work really pays dividends to our customers by reducing the overall cost and time schedule.
Yeah, that's one thing. There's other examples. Once the fuel is permanently out of the reactor, security perimeters change, physically change, so security costs can change, but there takes some physical change to the plant where those security barriers are. That's an example. There's a number of ways by planning ahead of time you can get ahead of those milestones so you're prepared for them when they occur and take advantage of them from a cost standpoint.
Great.
Scott, and then Linda, and then Alex.
Just a little bit of clarification on page 13. You're talking about, of course, the estimate, also what was approved, and, of course, where the trust fund is currently at.
Yes.
What I'm interested in, as far as I think I understand correctly, that so far to date, ratepayers have been paying a certain dollar amount on their bill. That goes into this trust fund, is that correct?
Well, they had in the past.
But not now?
Current customers are not paying into the Diablo Canyon decommissioning fund anymore because the fund level is at the level that the California Public Utility Commission believes is sufficient.
And that level currently is at what number?
Approximately $2.8 billion. You got to get careful with the numbers because we always have to submit based on, you know, inflation hits everybody, right? Mm-hmm. It hits everything. So you always submit based on a certain year's cost estimate, knowing that that cost will grow, and that's what happened with the fund. $2.5 billion was based on a specific year. I'm sure Lauren knows. Was it 2015? Mm-hmm. Was based on 2014. We know that the fund will grow because it is invested, and we know the cost will grow at the same time too.
Do you know what that growth rate is on that fund?
Well, it was. It's actually pretty good. It from 2015 to 2018, it's gone from 2.5 to 2.8 billion.
And who controls that? And who manages that?
Great question. Yeah, it's legally required by both the Utility Commission and the NRC for there to be certain governance over that trust fund. I sit on the Decommissioning Trust Fund Oversight Board as a member of the PG&E team, and we meet quarterly. That is all reviewed. The management of that fund is carefully monitored.
What company actually manages the dollars?
You know, I can't remember the name. We can get the answer mm-hmm. to that. And what I mean by that is we pay a management
yes,
company, kind of a fund manager, if you want to think about it,
yes.
to manage the trust fund, and they report out to us.
Just curious of what big firm that is. In reference to the estimate itself, if it was higher, if let's say the last time out it was granted at $3
billion, yes.
Since it was only at 2.5, that means that ratepayers would kick in at that time.
Yes. And you know, Scott, you're asking a really important question and one that we think is important for everyone to recognize. And that is that we really think it's very important to get the number right so that the customers that are benefiting from the generation of electricity yes. mm-hmm. will be the ones that fund the decommissioning fund. By state law, the decommissioning will be funded through rates of some sort. Mm-hmm. So if we get into decommissioning and we find out it costs more, then customers that are no longer benefiting from the generation from the site will now be paying for the decommissioning. So to your point, it's important for any rate effect to be established while the plant is still operating from a fairness standpoint of who's paying for decommissioning.
In relationship to the dollars that would be available, whether current now or later, for decommissioning, how do they relate to any current assets of the PG&E has of the site? In other words, if we're just talking out loud here, if there was something, a piece of property sold off,
yes.
would that offset that cost? for that budget?
Sort of, not really. Let me. I can talk a little bit about that. I know, Tom, you will. Tom's indicating he's got probably a better answer than me. I can talk to him, too.
So there's a process through the Public Utilities Commission called the 851 process. Okay. And any asset that has been burdened on behalf of customers, whether it was a lease or purchase or anything else like that, when it's disposed of, the recovery of those assets goes back into rates to help offset the overall cost of the operating the utility.
Okay.
It won't, in this instance, go back into the decommissioning trust fund. It would go back in the general rate process because the purchase of the power plant and those assets associated with it were part of the general rate cases.
So
PG&E.
Just so a different pot of money.
Different
pot of money, but it both goes back to the customer.
I understand.
Whether it was revenue from a lease or a sale or anything like that, it would go to offset
so
costs.
Those dollars are not commingled. We're truly looking at the overall process as far as this trust fund to support the decommissioning of this plant.
That's
that correct.
Yeah. And when we deal with land issues, if any land is sold and that land was part of the regulated asset, that the revenue would go back to customers.
Understood.
It would reflect it at whoever the customers at that time were.
Yes. Okay. So just one last comment. It seems like to me the quicker PG&E can get to a solid estimate, approved solid estimate, we would be essentially charging the appropriate people because it doesn't seem very appropriate that if we delay where maybe the use of the plant's not there anymore, it doesn't seem fair that any future ratepayer should have to pay for this. So.
I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly one of our desires is to ensure that the right customers pay for decommissioning.
Great.
Okay, Linda had a comment, and then Alex.
Unit 1 is shutting down in 24, and Unit 2 in 25. So how are they going to parse out the when you're going to file with the NRC for the removal of the fuel from Unit 1, and then you will be eligible to get money for the Unit 1 process, and then that'll happen again the year after? Is that how that'll work?
That's exactly right. Yeah, there are two funds, one for each unit, and as each of the units meets those milestones I described, then the additional portions of that unit's funding would become available.
Okay, thanks.
Alex?
Thank you. I had a question about slide number 8. Could you throw that up on the screen for a minute? This one, the slide, I think, shows the 10 CFR 50 site boundary. So what we're talking, as I understand that, is that's the NRC regulated site boundary.
That's
right,
correct.
John? So what and how many acres is that?
Oh, gosh. Is that 700 acres?
It's
not the full parcel.
Right.
It's not the full Diablo lands, but I don't think it's
so
700 acres.
Let's say 700 acres. I think that's what I'm hearing. The Diablo lands, broadly stated, I understand it's not all owned by PG&E. Some is owned, but about 12,000 acres.
Right.
So we're coming up soon to a discussion of land use and reuse of the operation. I think it's important to understand, for us to understand, community, that as far as NRC is concerned, that's the 700 acres that they regulate, right? And they don't regulate the 11,000 and, 300 other acres that are out there. So as far as once that's decontaminated to the radiological limits that NRC is happy with, essentially, NRC is good to go. It's safe as far as NRC is concerned from a radiological point of view, and they have preemptive status, and that's the end of the discussion, essentially. The state can impose other things, and PG&E has a lot of other lands out there, but they aren't going to be covered by the NRC regulatory process, I think is what I'm getting, right?
I think you have it exactly right. The only thing I would add to that is that the current plan is to collapse down to a spent fuel pool area, and that spent fuel pool area will continue to exist under an NRC license. Mm-hmm. So now that's, that goes from 700 acres to, a couple acres? actually, I think it's like 2 acres, where the spent fuel, the dry storage for the spent fuel will be. So they still will maintain purview over the spent fuel pool area. I mean, I'm sorry, the dry cask, the dry the dry cask storage facility.
Yeah,
they will still have purview there.
Okay, great. That's what I thought, and that's an important clarification. I mean, I think the other thing you mentioned at the beginning, John, and I'm concerned, I guess, about this is. We are engaged next month. We're having workshops on land use, right? The land use is for next week and next month, and the public is being invited to give presentations on, you know, PowerPoints, significant presentations will be invited. So that's good. And, you know, but do I understand you to say that in the last time the PUC dealt with this in this decision of January 16th of 2018, decision approving the retirement of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, the PUC ordered PG&E to establish a process that included this board and what we're supposed to be doing here, and it dealt with lands. And I want to read that because I think it's very important to, I don't think we're going to be done by the end of this year. It's the bottom line.
No,
I don't think, but here's what the PUC ordered PG&E to do on January 16th, 2018. Quote, Pacific Gas and Electric will take no action with respect to any of the lands and facilities, whether owned by the utility or a subsidiary, before the, and here's the key phrase, completion of a future process, including a public stakeholder process. That's this panel in part. There will be local input and further commission review prior to the disposition of Diablo Canyon facilities and surrounding lands. Now we're talking about the 12,000 acres. So completion of a future process, including the public state. Now, did you mention, say, at the beginning you thought this process would be complete by the end of this year?
No.
Okay.
Thank you for the clarification. We felt it was important to have at least a single swing at that prior to our filing at the end of the year, because some of that information will inform our cost estimates that we'll be submitting for that important, you know, first, you know, best cost estimate, as Scott had said, so we get the right amount of money into the decommissioning fund going forward. Now, this engagement panel and the engagement as required by the order, and I would actually note that that order was a reflection of our own submittal, because this is something we desired.
You committed to that in the process.
And then they came back and ordered us to do what we had suggested to do.
Right.
That's going to be ongoing. So that order is prior to us actually doing anything with the land. So we're not going to take any action with the land for many years. And so this engagement will continue. We want to get as much engagement out of the next couple so that it informs that funding requirement for the end of the year. And again, we're going to be filing at least two more times before final shutdown. And there are opportunities between those filings to have amendments. And so this is going to be an ongoing process for many years.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful clarification.
Thank you. Scott and then Frank.
Mine's real short, just kind of getting back to the funding. You mentioned that there was two trust funds for each one of the generators, I guess.
One for each unit.
So the grand total, is that for both?
The grand total is for both.
So is it like split 50-50, or is it? I'm just kind of curious.
You're asking trivia. Okay. You finally dug down deep enough to a point I don't know the answer to. Eric may know the answer to that one.
Yeah, it's roughly about 55-45 right now.
But it's grand total.
Okay, Frank, and then we'll move on to our next
presentation.
Thank you.
And if you go back to that same slide that Alex referenced, that I think was number 8, when we get into the land use discussion, will there be the ability to take those three areas that are concern, that need to be secured? Is there an area around that will be excluded? I guess I'm trying to determine where the boundaries will be for the areas that will of contamination.
I think the better way to say it is, as we, you know, and you're talking about security.
Yes, sir.
And I know you've had an opportunity to go to the plant, Frank, and you saw the security that we have. different stages of decommissioning, that security boundary will change. The security rules are based on protecting the radiological sources and ability to you know, get access to those radioactive sources or cause a problem. That will change at different stages. It will change when the plant is permanently defueled. It will change when the fuel is all placed in the dry cask storage facility. And each of those opportunities, that security boundary will change. And the cost as a consequence will change with it.
And I guess the reason I'm asking is I get people asking me, well, where is the area that you're talking about in discussion about land use? Because some of this area is secured and a lot of it is not.
Well, and I guess I'm being probably being overly prescriptive. I'm talking about the barbed wire fenced access controlled area. We actually are required by regulation to have security over what we call the owner controlled area, which goes even beyond that. But that's not the same thing as badged access. It's we have to maintain some security ability even beyond the immediate. And each of those will change.
Thank you.
Okay. I just add on to that. We're talking about all of it, all 12,000 acres, but think of it as in phases, right? So parcels to the north and south aren't nearly as affected as parcel P, where the power plant is. So we're talking about the ultimate disposition of the site over decades to come.
Got it. Thank you.
Let's move on to our next presentation. We'll have question and answer after that also.
Okay. And
so our next presenter is Eric Nelson, and Eric is the man in charge of the decommissioning planning. So
that's correct. Thank you. That was a good detailed intro. Should make the rest of these slides fairly easier to understand. So John went through the discussion of where we are with the respect to needing additional funds to perform all the planning activities that we have been discussing from 2019 through 2024. And again, as John discussed, they're really not available through the trust fund because of the two limitations, the first one being the 3% generic trust fund limit that the NRC has, and also the limit from the NRC, or the restriction on not using the trust fund for anything other than radiological decommissioning activities. So that leaves spent fuel management, site restoration activities, and the engagement panel. So we need to be able to address the funding really from both aspects of that, and I'm going to be covering that. So we considered three options. The first option we considered is, can we get an exemption from the NRC? It's an NRC restriction. Can we get an exemption from the NRC? And exemptions have been granted to the regulations that that John described, 10 CFR 50.75 and 50.82. So we took a detailed look at that, and we also did some benchmarking. What are the other exemptions? What has really the NRC used as their basis for granting exemptions? And there's really two considerations. One is that, as John described, an NRC exemption has never been granted to a plant that hasn't been shut down yet. So, again, we have the tremendous advantage of preparing to go into decommissioning, but we're so far ahead of where everyone else has been when they've granted that exception. That's something the NRC hasn't done. And then we took a look at specifically San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station, because they also did request an exemption from the regulations. And we read that very carefully. And what the exemption, so what Songs presented and what the NRC based their exemption approval on was the fact that their trust fund was already funded to the extent that it was above where they said our cost estimate is this much, and it was they had more money in that. So one quick, in terms of absolute detail clarity, is that when the NRC does that evaluation, essentially says, am I going to allow you to access this money? I want to make sure you have enough money in there to do what is in the scope of what needs to be done. They also have a very conservative allowance in there for trust fund growth by the managers, much less than we are getting, as John described, in terms of our actual rate of return, but the NRC actually factors that in. So we took a look at those two considerations, and obviously we're still operational, and the amount that we have presented to the NRC as part of a biannual requirement to identify to the NRC where we are with the trust fund aspect, we have told the NRC, consistent with what we've told the CPUC, we believe that this amount of funds is required to decommission the plant, and it is less than we currently have in the trust fund. Irrespective of how much the CPUC has approved, The amount that we have told the NRC and the CPUC that we believe we need to do decommissioning is less than we actually have in the trust fund, and even accounting for the conservative growth. So that leaves us with the conclusion that getting an exemption from the NRC to be able to allow access to the greater than 3% is unlikely. And there's one additional thing as well, is that from a timing standpoint, because we're going to be running out of the funding in the second quarter of 2019, getting a response from the NRC, even if we believed it to be successful, wouldn't necessarily be in time before we would exhaust the funds. And so we want to be in the position to continue to do the right planning to be able to reduce the overall cost of decommissioning to the PG&E customers. So for those reasons, we don't believe that that option is really a viable one for Diablo Canyon. So let's talk about option two. Option two is, well, can you go to the California Public Utilities Commission through the general rate case? Is that an option? And from, again, taking a look at, from considering that, there is no California precedent for using general rate case funds for decommissioning activities. That is really how the operational costs of the entire utility and all the utilities in the state is set up. That's why specifically the CPUC set up the decommissioning trust fund to be separate from that. And since that isn't a path that going through the GRC is not a normal path, and because we've set up a separate trust fund for that, we're not planning on pursuing that option. So since I said there were three options, option three must be where we're going. So we're going to, and we have actually last Monday, we requested a memorandum account from the California Public Utilities Commission. So what does a memorandum account do? What it does is it allows us to track decommissioning planning costs beyond those that are allowed by the NRC. So essentially what it says is, we know we're going to have costs, and we want to get agreement with the CPUC that it's okay for us to start tracking these costs for future cost recovery. Okay. Similar accounts have been granted by the California Public Utilities Commission. For an example, a natural disaster recovery cost. So if there's some natural disaster that occurs, CPUC has granted these memorandum accounts in the past. And the reason you do this is that when a natural disaster occurs, it isn't going to align with when your filing schedule is. So we're on a 3-year filing schedule for both the general rate case and for the decommissioning. So if a natural disaster occurs outside of that scheduled time frame, you really want to put in place a mechanism so that the utility has the ability and the confidence that, hey, we're going to be able to come back and demonstrate why these costs are prudent, but we want to set that up now so we can go address the issue. So that's really why the reason they set these up. And as I stated, the approval of the account, the memorandum account, is not a guarantee of cost recovery. It just says we're going to set up the ability to track the cost to be able to submit them for cost recovery in the future. So we looked at that. So what does that do for us? Well, that's going to allow us to continue for planning for decommissioning to continue at the level necessary to provide the lowest cost to the customers. So, you know, Don described all the good work we're trying to do to make sure we can move effectively right into decommissioning, take advantage of being able to do all of the permitting and the licensing in advance to be able to go right into there and not talk about, you know, the $85 million, say, in carrying costs if we're delayed. What we're going to be doing, so we, as I talked about earlier, we have submitted the request for the memorandum account. So what we're going to do as part of the 2018 NDCTP, Nuclear Decommissioning Cost Triennial Proceedings, I want to make sure I could say that at least once, we're going to be requesting funding as part of that submittal separate from the decommissioning trust fund. So what does that look like? What does that look like to the customer? So John talked about the fact that we are currently not collecting funds for Diablo Canyon. But if you pull your bill up, you will see that there's a decommissioning cost on there. We're actually getting costs for Humboldt Bay. So as an example, if you wonder, that's what's happening. But what the CPUC can do is through that same mechanism, and you'll see it on your bill as a decommissioning cost, behind the scenes, they can allocate where those funds are going. So John talked earlier about the fact that we have a commingled trust fund. So Eric's opinion here is if you were to go back to when we originally set up the trust fund and you really understood these regulations more carefully, we could have set up, or the CPC could have set up a mechanism where the monies they were collecting from the PG&E customers were designated into the specific buckets, where they could have said radiological decommissioning, site restoration, spent fuel management. That wasn't done, and that's part of sort of the conundrum we're in, is we know it was gathered for that, but they're not individually accounted for. So what we're going to be asking in the 2018 NDCTP is we want to be able to collect costs outside of the decommissioning trust fund itself, in addition to putting funds into the decommissioning trust fund, but as a separate portion, a separate funding mechanism, so that we can collect costs in both places so we can continue the planning. And what that does is that, again, and John talked about this, that we're going to do that, and we will have that in place for the 2018 filing. And why are we doing that? So what does it allow us to do? What's the benefits? It allows us to continue the critical decommissioning planning. It's consistent with the regulatory recovery mechanisms that are in place for similar situations. We've talked about the reasons why we went through the options and the reason we chose this. And it also doesn't depend on getting an NRC exemption request. So essentially, we're sort of moving the funding solution, working with the state, because that's really where the issue is trying to work with the state as opposed to having the funds be restricted through the NRC. So we're sort of moving it down to the level where it belongs. And also, it puts all of the decommissioning costs into the same CPUC proceeding. So again, we're going to go into the 2018 filing saying, here's all of the costs for decommissioning. And that's also consistent with the feedback that we've gotten from the CPUC in terms of, we would like to see the whole package here in terms of one filing. So it really accomplishes that. So just from a key takeaway standpoint, I'll do mine and John's covering the same thing. So the NRC restricts trust fund use, the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust Fund use. But we need additional funds to continue the decommissioning planning activities, including non-radiological decommissioning activities, spent fuel management, the engagement panel, and non-radiological site restoration. We're working on obtaining that funding for those planning activities from 2019 through 2024. Our filing date is December 2018. We will meet that filing date, and the filing will include funding for this engagement panel and all the necessary planning, permitting, and licensing activities. And then per state law, the costs of nuclear decommissioning, are recovered in rates. So with that, though, I think John probably answered the bulk of the questions. Are there any other ones that I can answer?
Okay, Linda, I'm going to go back. You had a question before our other.
I forgot it.
Okay. Kara, and then Lauren.
Thank you for that introduction. It's very interesting. So I'm not sure I entirely understand it, though. I understand there were three choices, and you ruled out one and two. We came up with a separate funding or memorandum account. And so I guess my question is, where does that money come to fund that memorandum account? Is that that piece on the bill that's sort of tagged as Humboldt Bay, but you think it can be used here? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let me clarify this.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. So what you'll see on the bill is there's a decommissioning cost number on your bill, and that is for PG&E customers. That's associated with Humboldt Bay, and it's associated with Diablo Canyon, sort of generically. But behind the scenes, how the CPUC or how where exactly which fund or what place that's going to, that's determined by how the CPUC sets that up. So what we're suggesting is that as part of our filing, that the funding needed to support the pre-planning activities that can't be accessed because of the NRC restrictions in the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust Fund for the activities between 2019 and 2024, we're going to be requesting that be a separate revenue stream be provided. What I was providing was as the customer. So if at the end of the day you ask me or you have to talk to the people in the community, well, where would I see that on that bill? It would be on that one line item on the bill.
Mm-hmm. You don't have the authority.
I think it's probably a little early for us to say exactly how the CPUC would do that, but we're going to request some funding outside the NRC Trust Fund for radiological decommissioning for this planning work.
Yeah.
I don't want to guess on where it's going to show up on your bill.
Question was, I understand you wanted to use this alternative source. I wasn't clear where that source was being funded, and it sounds like the short answer is ratepayers.
Yes.
But you still have to seek permission and receive permission from the PUC before that occurs.
That's correct. Okay. And it's probably important to note that this isn't additional money to spend. We're just spending it earlier so that we can lower the overall cost of decommissioning. Mm-hmm. If we were to wait until we had access under the NRC rules, we'd still have to do the same activities. It would just be much more expensive to do it then. Mm-hmm. So it's not more money we're asking for. It's just being able to get access to some of that money earlier. That's all.
With the hope that later, that first you get the approval to do that, and then secondly, later you can get reimbursed.
Well, if we can get access to it beforehand, there would be no need to reimburse it. Mm-hmm. We are going to hold some, we have asked to be able to hold some in a special account to be reimbursed if they don't give us the right to collect additional funding into a separate bucket out of the next filing.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Lauren? I know that PG&E is a public utility, heavily regulated, and I'm just curious to understand what that means. Are there ever any circumstances where the shareholders might be required to cover some of these costs, might be forced into it if the CPUC doesn't approve some of these? How does it work?
I can try to answer that one. By state law, the decommissioning work is considered part of the work that was required for the decision to have a nuclear plant and to generate electricity. And under that law, the customers through rates would pay for all decommissioning activities. Now, if we were to perform it in a manner that would be considered imprudent, not spend the money wisely, do something that made it more expensive than a prudent manager would execute, and we would be negligent in that fashion, and therefore the shareholders would have to pick up any costs that would be characterized based on some kind of negligent activity. Lauren has participated in numerous hearings concerning that kind of question, so maybe he can answer a little more.
Probably the best example I can give you, Lauren, is in the Humboldt case, when we go through a lot of the things, we have a reasonableness review like they will for Diablo Canyon. So how did we perform and execute when we did the work? And the best example I can think of is at Humboldt Bay, before we shut down, we were doing seismic upgrades to the facility that we never operated with, and so those costs for seismic upgrades were never approved as part of decommissioning because they weren't part of the operating plant. And so in that particular case, the shareholders did pay for the seismic upgrades rather than the ratepayers or rather than the CPUC approving it. That's probably the best example that we've had.
Lauren Sharp, just for the room, Lauren Sharp is our senior director for decommissioning. He has been responsible for the Humboldt Bay decommissioning is actually overseeing the preparation work in addition with working with Eric for the Diablo Canyon work as well.
So. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Scott, you had a question?
Oh, yes.
And then Frank, and then Alex.
I guess I want to tie this dollar amount that's on the bill that was mentioned for Humboldt Bay, I think you said. Now, how does that relate to the $2.8 billion that's in the trust fund?
It doesn't, in the sense that the money that's there's no more money today being collected for Diablo Canyon.
Mm-hmm. But what has been collected to date or continue to be collected? What is that dollar amount?
The amount that has been collected plus the interest that has been earned is equated up to $2.8 billion in today's dollars.
Yeah, I think we're mixing, managing to confuse ourselves. Pacific Gas and Electric is preparing for the decommissioning of Diablo Canyon. Mm-hmm. We are currently executing a decommissioning of a nuclear facility at Humboldt Bay. Mm-hmm. That project is... let's call it 85% complete. The total cost of that project is about $1.1 billion. We've spent most of that already, and most of the job is done. Since that plant shut down after a relatively short run, this was a case where customers were required to pay for the decommissioning after the plant shut down. And, in fact, we're still collecting a small amount to finish off the job at Humboldt Bay.
When did it shut down?
I think the final shutdown was 1976.
So it's been shut down since 1976.
Is that right?
That's the right date. Yeah, 1976. Okay.
That's now, the kind of time frames we're talking about.
Yeah. Now, in this case, the plant went to SafeStore, and we didn't actively start like really decommissioning until about 10 years ago. But it sat in SafeStore. The funding was not available to decommission it. It did not run for anywhere near the length of Diablo Canyon, and as a consequence, there was funding required for decommissioning following shutdown.
Frank?
Just a quick comment, and I think it's important for the public to know. I know we're talking a lot about funding, and we're talking a lot about the engagement panel. The engagement panel is not being paid. We're doing this for fun.
Yeah.
Okay, Alex.
Eric, could you get up the slide to set 19, I think it was, 19? I think that was the one I had a question on. Maybe that isn't it. Could you go to 18? I'm sorry. Maybe it's 19. Let's go to 19. Here is a question or a point I have I think is important to make. The NRC requires all utilities and all companies who run nuclear power plants to have a decommissioning fund and to sock this money away during the operational life of that reactor. And that is a lockbox fund that is set aside under very rigorous regulations that NRC has, and that money cannot be touched. And one of the reasons why they have these strict rules about 3% or not take, because they don't want people to dip into that money before the decommissioning gets going. So they want to preserve that money for the long term, and that's the whole point. They guard that money very closely. If I may ask, we're talking about the decommissioning estimate or fund. At the last PUC proceeding last year, the PUC said $2.5 billion, right?
That's correct.
And there's currently $2.8 billion in the fund for Diablo Canyon?
That's correct.
Do we get $300 million back?
No.
No, that's a bit of a joke. Well, no. Here's my question. What is the NRC's figure? The NRC has a regulation that prescribes exactly, that's a generic estimate, how much the decommissioning has to be. What is that number?
For Diablo Canyon.
For Diablo Canyon.
It would be $1.2 billion.
So as far as NRC's generic regulation is concerned, the decommissioning of the plant is $1.2 billion. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I understand that there's a biennial proceeding that the company has to submit to the NRC, and it's based upon a generic until 5 years before, and then it's a costs site-specific. But I think it's an important data point to say that NRC's regulations currently prescribe the decommissioning cost of $1.2 billion, and there's $2.8 billion in the fund.
There's a couple of clarifications. If I can ask, there's a couple of clarifications. First of all, the NRC rules only account for radiological decommissioning.
Right.
So under the NRC rules, we could spend the $1.2 billion to remove all the radiation. We could leave all the buildings. We could leave all the roads. We could leave everything else behind. The state would never allow that. So the fund, and that's what the point we made earlier about the commingling of funds. We could have just a radiological decommissioning fund. fund for each right. unit. And at $1.2 billion, I don't know, we haven't broken it out like that, but $1.2 billion might be sufficient in order to execute that work. Now, the state's never going to let us do that. That's why they're funding us at a much higher level. So the remaining money is for the rest of the work, which is not trivial. That it's an important distinction.
Okay. Thank you. Linda?
I remembered my question, and I have another one. On that slide that we just saw, slide 8, with the area, just for clarification, aren't you saying that the three parts that are highlighted there in the brown, those are the radiological areas, right? That's what you're saying?
Those are the areas that we consider, those are the areas where we know there'll be radiological remediation
right.
performed.
Don't they say you have to take all that away and make it go, make it not be there anymore?
No. What when you say that, you got to be careful. When you say take that away, the way the NRC rules work. Now, they recognize I didn't go into a lot of detail, but the state rules are very different from the NRC rules.
I'm talking NRC.
The NRC says we have to take away all radiological sources. So let's look at the bottom, the big area around the power plant. Okay. A large area, most of those buildings on the outside don't have any radioactivity in them, or very minimal.
Okay.
So we could take the components that might have some radiation out and leave the components that never saw radiation and still meet the NRC release criteria for the station. Nobody does it that way because most sites are similar to ours. They want to remove the facility so it can be used for something else in the future. But if under strict interpretation of the NRC rules, so long as we took all the radioactivity out, everything else could remain.
So, and then the one that's kind of oblong, that's up by the emergency pools, is that the old steam generator, or what's in there?
That's actually
the long oblong is, that's where the dry cast storage is. And
no,
at the very top.
The long oblong is the dry cast storage area.
Oh,
yeah, that's.
Oh,
that's
I right. thought that was over to the left, but so that stays.
Yeah, when we drove the bus up by the, right. we parked just below those
right,
pools
right.
and
okay.
looked at the storage facility.
Okay, and then the one up above, that's the old steam generator.
That's
yes.
correct.
And that has to go away.
The steam generators will have to go away.
Okay, thank you. And then my other question was, this is going back to the last presentation, I'm sorry, but the agreement was that the land can't be sold or distributed or anything till shutdown, right?
It depends on what agreement you're talking about. I think what the rule was, we cannot act on any disposition of lands until we engage with the community. So,
oh, okay.
so that's what we're doing now. It's what we'll continue to do
okay.
For many years.
So there's no like time that doesn't say it has to be 2025 before the decision is made. Okay. So the question I have was, all this 12,000 acres of land, PG&E purchased it, right? And did they purchase it with ratepayer money?
You're asking a very simple question with a complicated answer, so of course I'm going to turn to Mr. Jones to help me with that one.
Portions of it were encumbered with utility assets, with utility rates. That's the parcels north of the power plant. The parcels from the power plant south to Avila Beach were actually originally leased by the utility from the Robert Murray Cattle Company.
Okay.
Subsequently, that institution went bankrupt, and Eureka Energy acquired the title actually across the street at a sale by the county, ultimately due to default of taxes.
But Eureka Energy is a subsidiary of PG&E, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But those lands were not placed in the rate base.
Correct. They were out of rate base.
So they were not treated as regulatory assets.
Correct.
So basically they were paid for by out of the profits of
PG&E? By shareholders.
By shareholders. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not as simple. Some lands are in one condition, some are another. When Tom talked about the 851 process, for all regulated assets, disposition of those will go through the CPUC. Since that was purchased on behalf of the ratepayers and was treated as a regulatory asset that was earned on, it would go through the 851 process.
So that map we've looked at before, there are 44 different parcels, some of which are owned by the affiliate, some of which are owned by the regulated utility, and all have some level of encumbrances on them, whether there's easements for other property owners or leases from one party to another. So all 44 parcels, I would suggest to you, are unique, both in size and in the restrictions on them.
And there'll be we'll know where the money came from for each one of those parcels.
Correct. We have that designated now on that map we've used before. There's the orange color that shows that's owned by the utility.
Yeah.
And then there's a green shading from the power plant south that represents Eureka Energy ownership.
Okay. Thank you.
We have time for one more question or comment before our break. Alex?
Yes, Eric. Question on slide 21. The request for memorandum account, I guess that's what it's called, memorandum account. Is that a rate-making process that PUC would trigger? That would trigger a rate-making process?
What that does is it allows us to start tracking the costs. We will address the rate-making process in the 2018 NDCTP.
I understand. Yeah, that's the plan, to fold it into the triennial proceeding,
right.
Decommissioning cost. Would it be possible for it to be a separate rate-making process, i.e. for operating costs, for current operating costs?
No, I don't think it would be.
Does it have to be part of the triennial?
Let's be careful. You're using a very specific term. A memorandum account isn't part of rate-making. We're not changing rates with a memorandum account. All it is asking for the Utility Commission to recognize a certain account that where we're going to track spending money, which later in some other rate mating process we will ask for recovery of. It's really just a means of keeping track of spending of a specific type with the understanding that later we will come and request those funds. In this case, through a decommissioning fund process.
Okay, but I thought it was you say that all you can get is $37 million from the NRC process. You need more than that. You want to get some more money now. So how are you going to get that money if you're just taking it out of the 2.5 that they've approved for decommissioning? That may be problematic.
Well we can't take it. Again, we can't go beyond the 37.2 out of the decommissioning trust funds because we need to be in compliance with the federal regulations.
For the NRC.
Right. The memorandum account allows us to simply track the costs above the $37.2 million. We will address how we are proposing to recover the money through whatever the rate mechanism in the 2018 NDCTP. And what that allows the commission to see is the holistic costs associated with decommissioning Diablo Canyon. And then we will propose rate making for how either a portion of it is coming into the decommissioning trust fund for the majority, but for the planning through another rate mechanism. And that's our obligation to do that. But again, it puts it into one view for the CPUC.
All right. I think, Alex, the way to think about it is the memorandum account is a bridge. We know that it's that we expect, based on our spending rate and our scope, to be finished with the 37.2 sometime second quarter next year. But we don't expect the commission to have ruled on the nuclear decommissioning triennial cost proceeding that we're going to file at the end of this year prior to the end of second quarter next year. So this memorandum account will keep track of funding until they can rule on our filing, which we will be filing in December. So it's really just a way to bridge, and it's not a lot of money because all the vendor work will be done. It's principally answering questions of the filing and doing a little bit of early work, but it's not a lot of money.
Okay, thank you all. And we're going to take a 10-minute break. And when we come back, we'll begin with our public comment. I would like everyone in the audience, anyone who wants to make a public comment right after the break, please make sure that you've handed a blue card to one of the
PG&E representatives in the audience or to me up here. So with that, we will reconvene at 8:25. Thank you very much. We have one card comment. So, William Toman, please state your name and address, and you have 3 minutes to present to the panel.
Thank you very much. It's really just a question. I'm Bill Toman from Los Osos. How can PG&E and the Utility Commission reconcile the very, very large differences in the decommissioning cost estimates between San Onofre and Diablo Canyon? As you noted, they're very similar in many, many, many measures, similar size, similar volumes of concrete to be removed, similar vintage, both in the state of California, same regulation, same, but there's a very large difference between the cost estimates. It seems that there's a justification found in songs for the much higher cost estimate.
Yeah, I think Eric can probably do a great job answering that.
I think you've exactly described the burden that we have with respect to the 2018 NDCTP. It's up to PG&E to be able to make the case for what the right amount of funds for decommissioning are, and to be able to clearly articulate that to the CPUC such that it's a convincing case and such that they agree with us and adjust rates accordingly. So that's really our obligation. That's what we have spent all the time doing, the site-specific decommissioning cost estimate and getting external experts for, is to be able to better articulate and document the activities that are going to be required to decommission the plant.
Right, and so as a follow-up, proposed decision of the administrative law judge that rejected the increase in the Diablo decommissioning costs last year was because it wasn't properly justified, as opposed to the lower amount has been calculated to be the correct number.
What I would say is that the judge identified what she felt was the appropriate amount that had been justified by PG&E for decommissioning. And it's our obligation to do better this time and to address the issues that the judge specifically called out for those areas where we didn't provide, in her view, adequate documentation and justification for those additional costs.
And in the past, because the joint proposal had not been arrived at, PG&E had not gone beyond generic studies to get your estimate, and now you're going to get very serious about a very precise estimation of the total cost.
I wouldn't use exactly those terms, but yes, and I would say we're already well along the way, and we will meet the deadline. So we have been actively working with industry experts on that, taking very sharp notice of the specific areas where we did not get the exact funding that we had requested, and we are going after those.
And then, and finally, a question. In the $2.5 billion cost estimate, does that include the removal of all the 500 kV lines out to the Central Valley, out to Midway and Gates?
No, in that estimate, I don't believe it did in that one in particular.
But will that be included? In other words, will those will those transmission lines be removed after 2025?
No. They will remain in place. They're important infrastructure for the transmission capability of PG&E in the Central Coast.
Okay, and that will go all the way from the Diablo switchyard out to...
They will not be removed, yeah. You're correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tolman. That concludes our public comment period. So the next thing on our agenda is panel discussion. But before we do that, I want to quickly review the public comments that we've received to date. And just point out that we have received almost 50 comments, and this is through a number of medium. This is public individuals filling out the public comment form that's on the website. This is input from panel members, from community members they've talked about, or organizations and associations, some cases emails that have been received. So there are, and in addition, all of the public comment that we've received at prior meetings. So there are many, many venues for the general public to provide input. Really encourage everyone to do so. And all of that input is being kept track of and being reviewed. So with the next agenda items being lands and repurposing over the next couple of months, I would anticipate we're going to have a significant rise in those numbers. So that's a report on the public outreach. So with that, let's move on to our next agenda item, which is panel discussion and comments. So are there any items or concerns or issues that the panel would like to raise, or questions of PG&E in general? Kara.
So I'm not sure if I'm doing this in the right order, but I did want to make a few comments in response to public outreach efforts. Should I hold off until we get through this?
No, this would be appropriate.
Okay. So I think part of the reason I may have been selected for this panel is that I've been very interested in land conservation, in particular Wild Cherry Canyon and the Diablo Canyon lands. As a result of that affiliation, since being on the panel, I have been contacted by many, many people and groups who are extremely interested in the land issues. Some are interested in repurposing, perhaps on Parcel P, but the vast majority of people I've been talking to are very interested in the conservation of and public access to all of the Diablo lands, except those portions that have to be protected or secured for continuing plant operations. So in that vein, over the next couple days, I'm going to be sending out an email that provides specifics about, it's just another forum for people to get information about future tours of the land that may be possible in the month of August. We're also going to be having some public workshops. I want to get the word out about those dates and times and places. And then the big land hearing, of course, is at the end of the month, next month, August 29th. And so if people want to have information about that, I would encourage you to do one of two things. Number one, check on Facebook, go to Friends of Wild Cherry Canyon, and we'll be posting a lot of details about upcoming workshop, tour, and the hearing dates. And secondly, if you want to receive the email that I'll be sending around, feel free to email me your email address, and I'll make sure on that list. My email address is easy. It's just karaslow@charter.net, K-A-R-A-S-L-O at charter.net, and I'll make sure you get the email with all the detailed information for next month. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Kara. Any other comments or questions? Linda.
Something occurred to me in the past few minutes, which was, now, the money from the joint proposal that you had proposed to the PUC, part of that money was rejected, the part for the retraining and retention, I believe, of employees and some other parts of it. And I think that was quite a bit of money. But now there is legislation to cover those costs that were not allowed in the CPUC case, that the money would come out of the taxpayers rather than the ratepayers. First of all, am I right about that? And second of all, doesn't that kind of make up the gap between what you asked for and what you got?
A couple clarifications. So the employee retraining portion of the joint proposal was fully funded at $11.3 million. The retention originally proposed at 25%. The CPC awarded 15%. So Senate Bill 1090 by Senator Mauning and co-authored by Assemblyman Cunningham seeks to make up the balance of all aspects of the joint proposal that were not enforced from the utilities decision. Okay, so that would make it whole from its original proposal with that large coalition that supported it.
So then you wouldn't have a deficit. I mean, you won't have a deficit if that's passed, right? I mean,
are you referring to the deficit in terms of what we're seeking to gain from the nuclear decommissioning cost triennial proceeding? Because those are separate cases.
No. Yes.
Yeah.
Let me
just take one step back. So the joint proposal is about the continued operation and transition of from Diablo Canyon to new ways to deal with that energy demand, whether energy efficiency, renewable power, etc. That is funded from rates from an operational perspective. That was a special rate case that augmented the general rate case way we collect revenues to operate the utility. The trust fund proceedings are separate for retiring the power plant. That deficit that you're referring to, that we've been referring to tonight, where we have the burden of making the case for getting more revenue, will be in the 2018 filing on a separate revenue collection that would be noted in the decommissioning trust fund portion of the line item on the bill. Okay, so two separate revenue streams, separate work, one for operations, one for retiring the facility.
Okay. Lauren.
I'm looking at the draft agenda, and I see that the next item is introduction for the next meeting topic. What I don't see here, and maybe it was added in the final agenda, is some discussion about the workshops. That's only 3 weeks away, and I'm concerned that people aren't going to have enough time to prepare presentations at the workshops. What are we doing about that?
That would be included in the next presentation.
You're two slides ahead of me.
Good catch, though. Any other questions or comments? Move forward. Okay. So the next item is exactly what Lauren discussed, and it's a great segue. Introduction to the next meeting topics. So I'll turn that over to Tom Jones.
Thanks, Chuck, and thanks, Lauren. So, yes, we have the two next panel meetings are August 29th and September 26th. August 29th, we'll deal with the future use of lands, and we're looking for ideation, concepts from people on what they'd like to see happen with those properties. And then September 26th is more the discussion around repurposing. And remember, going back to the last judge's decision on the 2015 estimate or NDTCP, there was, you know, a specific order. Do you really have to remove the breakwater? Investigate that, consult with regulators, and then that begs the question, if it stays, what purpose does it serve, right? That gets us into the repurposing discussion. If we go to the next slide, we have the workshops, the dates and the locations now. So our partners at the city of Pismo Beach graciously offered their city hall for these two meetings, which is closer to where we think some affected groups are for the future land use. So we have the city hall available for those 2 days, and then the panel meeting afterwards. And then the repurposing will be in Atascadero. Again, the panel gave us some direction to try to seek some geographic diversity so folks could participate in different locations. And these... Then the second workshop for repurposing, the reason for having it delayed behind the land use is some of those concepts might be more complex than simple conservation or trail discussions. But that won't be exclusive to repurposing. They'll have a priority. If there's a group that can't make the August dates work, we'll try to find time for them in September. And in front of that, or in parallel with that, on the next slide, we have these tour dates. So that we've already issued a press release, and I know many of the members of the panels have pushed out this information. We have a carrying capacity, a baseline carrying capacity of 660 seats, and thanks to a number of the panelists who helped participate in a dry run of that. It takes about 3 hours, so folks can experience the full run of coastline and see some of the assets that could be repurposed at a future, in a future date. And so that information is on our website. We've pushed it out in press release. We'll start getting those reservations filled up. In addition, if there's anything the panel needs, we can accommodate additional tours on top of this, but that'll be limited to about 18 folks based on those the two vans that the company owns. So we have a total carrying capacity, if we use these dates plus with the vans, of 1,020 people. I don't think we'll hit that mark, but I'm really impressed with what the team was able to put together to get folks out there in the next 60 days. So again, here are the dates and time. We'll be issuing a press release on this, and I think the panel will have everyone here will be making some call to action from their different constituencies, and we'll collect that information and determine who will be presenting. The format that the panel did discuss at the administrative meeting was approximately a 30-minute presentation, then the panel will have about 15 minutes of Q&A, and then you discuss amongst yourselves and then have the next group come up. So we still need panelists. We'll have to get the logistics down of which panelists are serving which dates and how we do this. But these meetings will be open to the public, but they won't have public comment. This will be invited folks that are in through the stakeholder process that have something to offer, whether it be a group that's interested in conservation or trail riding or repurposing. So we know there's a lot of different groups out there, but I think we're going to hear from a lot more folks once we start this outreach through our various networks.
Frank.
I think it would be important to somehow, and I don't know when this is going to happen, but we're going to be getting a lot of folks that are going to be talking about the repurposing and land use, and this commission has discussed it as well. I'm hoping that we can come away with some credibility to say that we're here to do something and that there's going to be a definitive, some sort of definitive direction given, and hopefully that'll be well received. I would hate to think that we would go through this whole exercise and gather public input, gather the ideas, and then find out that that's not where we're going to go. So I don't know how and when that has to happen, but in order to gain any kind of credibility for this engagement panel and for the public and PG&E, there's got to come a time when something is defined.
Thank you. Any comments on that? Yes, Lauren?
Just to follow up on Frank's comment, I'd like to make the point that these workshops and the presentations are not only an opportunity for presenters to make known to this panel and to PG&E their ideas, but it is a very important opportunity to introduce these ideas to the general public. You know, we are here representing the public, and I see part of our function is to stimulate this kind of conversation, to encourage it. And, you know, it's not just our panel that needs to get behind an idea that we can endorse, but the larger public, because if there are ideas that are well received by the general public, there could be a groundswell of support that might be important from a getting approvals from necessary government bodies, but also perhaps stimulating the creation of some fundraising mechanisms that might make possible some of the wonderful ideas I'm sure we're going to hear. Ideas that might involve dedicating some of the lands, for example, to public use. Who's going to pay for it? Alex has been emphasizing that.
Alex?
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that comment. I mean, one of the reasons we're having these workshops is that I'm frustrated by a process where members of the public get 3 minutes at the podium in an evening session, maybe a total of a half an hour. And there's a lot of very involved and creative and concerned people out there who about the decommissioning of the Diablo and the use of the lands. And there are a lot of ideas out there. And we thought, let's set up a workshop, you know, 2 days in August, all day long, where people who want to give a pitch, give a PowerPoint presentation, do something serious, give them 15 minutes or a half an hour, put together a proposal, a thought-out analysis, and maybe even how they think somebody's going to pay for it. Because this isn't just a Christmas tree with money falling from heaven. PG&E owns this 12,000 acres, and it's valuable property. And they aren't just going to give it away. So if somebody says, let's make the whole thing a state park, it's great. I love it. I'm a docent out of Montana de Oro. I'd love to double a Montana de Oro property. But, okay, let's figure out. Maybe somebody can come up with an idea how that's going to happen and how it's going to be paid for. Because we can all ask for the sky, but let's get down to brass tacks a little bit. And these proceedings will be recorded and they will be submitted to the PUC. And it will be used in other proceedings, state proceedings on this site. So if there's somebody out there who's got some group out there that's got a good pitch, let's hear it. And we're going to, hopefully, we'll get a number of good ones, and we might be oversubscribed and have to shorten it down from an hour to a half an hour or do another one or something. But let's hear some good ideas, and let's find out how it's going to work and how it's going to be paid for. And I hope people will sign up and help us out here.
And Mr. Carlin, just to add to that, while they might have a time limitation, there's no limitation on the volume of documentation they wish to supplement that presentation, right? So,
absolutely. There are many ways to submit stuff to this. That's a point you make. You can submit a comment. You can submit lots of stuff on the webpage. So it's not just a pitch. But it would be nice to have a presentation so we could ask some questions so the public could hear it. And it could be recorded and you could watch it or something. So.
It's Kara.
I wanted to tell you a little bit about the groups I've already heard from who are very interested in making workshop presentations. And I don't think anybody I've spoken to has come to this with the expectation that good things were going to fall from a tree. I think everybody that I've talked to is very realistic about what it takes to create a trail or to create a state park and how do you raise that money. And I do think at the presentations we're going to hear very specific recommendations on raising, for example, money from the June park bond that just passed. There are monies available for land acquisition and public recreation. So I'm really encouraged by what I've heard so far. And I just want to mention already I've heard from trail groups, equestrians, mountain bikers, the Slow Land Conservancy, different plant groups, tribal groups, the Sierra Club. That's a small sampling of the people who are talking to me about wanting to try to prepare a presentation. And so far, I'm just really impressed by the level of expertise amongst these folks who've done a lot of projects like this in the past. So I think we're in for a really interesting month in August. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Any further comments or observations? Well, that concludes our agenda. Oh, I'm sorry, Scott.
Just sitting, listening, and looking towards the future as far as what we're going to be talking about as far as land use and things of that nature. It just keeps coming back to me looking at the map. And really what I see is two different entities. We see PG&E as the producer of energy, and then we have a subsidiary, which is another entity. And so, you know, even though we may have presentations and so forth coming forward, I'm just wondering if we really have the right people in the room, because if we're talking about a separate entity, I think they have probably certain rights, what they can and cannot do with the property. And I know that they're tied together. I know they're associated with each other, and there might be some limits as far as what you can do with the property now until there's decisions made on the overall power plant. But I just see that we might be having two different agencies or two different entities that we need to have the discussion with, because the people that own probably quite a bit of the property you know, they're not sitting in the room right now. Well, of course, there's, go ahead.
Yeah, two of the four are. So okay. Eureka Energy has a board of directors of three folks. So mm-hmm. the chief nuclear officer, Jim Welsh, Diablo Canyon, he is the CEO of Eureka Energy. And John Frank is one of the other impaneled mm-hmm. directors of that corporation. And then I'm the day-to-day implementer for Eureka Energy. So John is one of the three decision makers on that body. Mm-hmm. The other is down the street, and all three work together very closely. So this information will get to all the right people, and most, and they're participating. You have a third of our board of directors here tonight. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't use Eureka Energy to say it's not Pacific Gas and Electric's property. Mm-hmm. The use of that formation really was to distinguish it whether or not it was a regulatory asset that we would earn off of. Mm-hmm. You know, our customers aren't paying rates to account for the capital expense of that land, basically. So it does mean that the land doesn't roll through the CPUC in an 851 process if we were to sell it. It is shareholder land. Mm-hmm. But it is important to make that distinction. I appreciate you doing that. Mm-hmm.
Any further comments? Thank you all very much. Consistent with our prior meetings and our agenda, one of the things we want to do is do a quick assessment to identify the things that you feel this meeting that you liked, and also opportunities for improvement in an effort to continuously improve this process and its effectiveness. So with that, anyone want to comment on things that you liked about this meeting? Dina?
So I want to thank the PG&E staff. You guys always do a fantastic job of informing us and answering all of our questions. So it was a great presentation. And John, thank you for all of the information, and Tom and Eric. It's not a super exciting subject, but it's very detailed. So I know you don't get to do fancy PowerPoints or anything, but we really appreciate it. The information was very direct, very informative, and I think I know I'm walking away from tonight with a much better picture and a little different picture than I had originally in my mind. So thank you very much.
Any other object? Yes, Sherry.
Yes. Well, this is tangential, really, but I was so impressed with the dry run that was done for the Diablo lands, and impressed with the amount of energy that's going into it and presentation and so forth. So I want to express my thanks for that.
It's liquid energy.
Kara.
I love the way Dina put it. I thought it was a great presentation. I always learn from these presentations how much I don't know, but this was very helpful today. Appreciate the time and effort that was put into it. Thank you.
Thank you. What could we do better? How can we continuously improve these meetings? Is there anything that you would recommend we do differently or try to do?
What was that?
Wine.
are you referring to an adult beverage or an act by someone not happy?
Okay, great. I did just get I'm sorry, Lauren.
I'm just aware of how much we're trying to pack into a very short period of time. And the pressure on PG&E team has only increased with the now updated requirement to finish their process by the end of this year. And one of the consequences of that is that I think it's very tough to really publicize adequately and far enough in advance the opportunities that the public has to get involved in this. And I'm sure, well, I just want to encourage PG&E to really put major efforts into publicizing the workshops and the two meetings that are coming up. They're super important.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have an outreach plan for that. It'll be pretty aggressive, and we'll count on your help again through all your different channels. In addition, once we submit the application, that starts approximately a 20-month public process where folks can also participate. And concurrent with that process, this panel will still meet. So remember, we have, I think it was 38 opportunities between now for this panel to meet through 2025, plus the 50 to 60 some odd other regulatory proceedings. So we're going to count on this panel to help us keep pushing that information out, and we'll do the same in parallel, as will those agencies. They'll have their own public outreach that they do. You know, the Utilities Commission will reach out to consumer groups. They'll notice their own meetings, et cetera.
Suzanne pointed out that Trevor said he wanted to make the point he was still alive and watching, and he said there was a good level of content and detail. So I also want to point out to the members of the public that we want your input also, and there are white cards out there, and if there's anything you think would improve these meetings that we could consider for the next meeting, please fill out a card and give it to one of the staff. In closing, I would like to recognize the panel and each of you for the time and effort that you put into this process. As was pointed out, you are not being paid for this. And this is time and effort dedicated on your behalf and dedicated on behalf of your the people of the community and your neighbors. And you're signed up for somewhere between a 1 and 3 year commitment. And it's I just want to recognize you for the time and effort that each one of you has put into this process and what you've committed to in the future. Just thank you. With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.